everyone. My name is George Qureshi, and I am the editor of Howler Magazine. Today on Howler Radio, we have a story that kind of sort of comes from the newest issue of the mag. It's by Justin Bryant, who played as a goalkeeper overseas and here in the U.S. during the pre-MLS dark days of the late 80s and 90s. Justin has a story in the new issue that goes into some pretty great detail about just how hilariously small time the USISL was back then. The story he's telling here on the podcast was cut from that piece. It was interesting, but it kind of felt like it led the reader off into a dead end. So we asked him to record it, and today you're going to hear about a goalkeeper playing a soccer game while utterly zonked on, I'm not going to tell you what kind of drug. But I am going to tell you very briefly, before we get to Justin's story, a little bit about what else we have in the new issue. It ships starting on Tuesday of next week, by the way. Robert Andrew Powell, who recorded the very first episode of Howler Radio and who wrote our issue 2 profile of Hercules Gomez, is back, and he goes deep in a profile about Ray Hudson. I guarantee you know Ray's voice, but his story, how he moved from Newcastle to Southern Florida as a young player and just never left, is classic soccer Americana. Another writer, Allison McCann, used to play soccer for Stanford, and now she works at Business Week, but two of her former college teammates are fucking killing it over in the Damallsvenskan, which is Sweden's pro league. In fact, one of them, Kristen Press, who is fast becoming a big-time player on the U.S. women's national team, was this past year's Skytte Drottningar. I'm pretty sure I butchered that. It literally means shooting queen, which I totally love. Anyway, Allison went over to Sweden in October to write about the players, including Kristen, who found a new home there after the WPS folded. We have a very detailed timeline on the history of Real Madrid, and that is accompanied by a piece written by Sid Lowe. It's actually from his new book, which you can't even get in the U.S. yet, called Fear and Loathing in La Liga. Sid's piece is about Santiago Bernabeu, and it has what might be the best photo in the whole issue, showing Bernabeu sitting at his desk and ashing a cigar into some cup, like a trophy, that Real Madrid had won. It's just really fantastic. There's actually a lot of Madrid in this issue. Brooks Peck is back with the second installment of his detective series, and this one focuses on Mourinho's troubles over the last little period of his time in charge of Real Madrid. And we have a little arts and crafts project, a page that you can cut out and fold and paste together to make a mini Estadio Santiago Bernabeu. Of course, our cover story is all about Barcelona. We have two essays, one by a poet, a dreamer, about how Neymar and Messi will create the most beautiful soccer you've ever seen, and another by a cynic, a writer who argues that there is just no way these two can coexist in the same locker room. Of course, the issue is 108 pages, so there's a lot I can't even get to. Adam Hurry, who runs a great blog called Football Clichés, looks at the tortured, tortuous language of soccer. And Matthew Doyle continues his series on the evolution of the U.S. men's national team with an essay that examines how the team has changed under Klinsmann and how, and this is even more interesting in my opinion, how Klinsmann has changed his approach over time to better suit the players available to him. We've packed all of this, and believe it or not, quite a bit more into the next issue. You can see what some of the pages look like and purchase the mag at howlermagazine.com. We also like to show it off on Twitter and Instagram. Both are at whatahowler and Facebook, which is facebook.com/whatahowler. So follow us there and you'll see these updates. All right. I'm done with the sales pitch and we can get on with the show. Our producer, Matthew Nelson, is going to set up Justin's story for you right now.
We are but we also need to respect the work that people put into things.
Valium was the most prescribed medication in the United States from its release in 1963 until 1982, and is still one of the most commonly used benzodiazepines. Please ask for and review all of the patient information provided by your doctor before taking this medication. However, it should always be used under the direct care of a physician.
The chances are that you've never heard of Justin Bryant. In a career that spanned just over a decade, Justin was a professional goalkeeper in the loosest sense. He was paid to play football, but he never really made a living from it. There were stops in the US with the Orlando Lions, jaunts to England with non-league side Boreham Wood, as well as trials at established professional sides like Brentford and Dunfermline. But Justin never really made it as a pro, and he retired from the game in 1996 after playing his last season with the Coco Expos in Florida. But there is one detail about Justin's short, undecorated career that is quite exceptional. He once played a game while totally bombed on Valium.
Valium is available orally, rectally, via injection, and as a powder that can be inhaled. Oral options include tablets, capsules, and a liquid form. Dosages vary from 2 to 30 milligrams.
Okay, so let's back up, because if there was ever a story that required a bit of context, it has to be this one. As I said, Justin spent much of his nomadic career zigzagging across the Atlantic, playing on the fringes of the professional game. His last stop was in the United Systems of Independent Soccer League's 95-96 season with the Coco Expos.
Some people might remember the name Ricky Hill, a former midfielder for Luton, who got 3 caps with England. Ricky was brought over to be the coach. He was not coach in name. The team was owned and run by an older gentleman.
A guy named Rick Stotler, who insisted on being referred to as the head coach.
But Ricky actually did all the actual day-to-day training. He took the team training, and he picked the team, and he really ran it. We had a good team. I mean, that was a league with a large variety of quality. There were some very good teams, and there were some teams that were not even particularly good, as wouldn't even be good college teams. But we had a bunch of genuine ex-pros. In addition to Ricky, we had a few guys who'd gone through Chelsea's youth system right from the beginning of the season. We just won game after game. But it was a poorly organized club, and it wasn't a particularly well-organized league.
Okay, let's talk about the United Systems of Independent Soccer Leagues for a moment. This was a venture that existed in the limbo period between the demise of the North American Soccer League in 84 and the genesis of Major League Soccer in 96. Now, this was a confusing time in the tangled history of professional football in this country, and a time when people thought that the best way for a league to avoid extinction was to kind of monkey around with the game's DNA. So if you went to USISL game during the season that Justin was playing, you get this kind of warped version of conventional football where the laws had been fundamentally changed.
The two most prominent ones were the timekeeping. Instead of playing 90 minutes, we played 60 minutes, but the referee stopped his watch every time the ball went out of play. That law didn't seem to make any difference. It really didn't. Games lasted just about the same as a 90-minute game. The other one that was really strange is that if a team committed 7 fouls in a given half, the other side got a penalty. So every foul, the referee would take his book out and make a little mark, and he would keep track of them. And this is almost impossible for players on the pitch to keep track of in the heat of the game. So we had an assistant coach who kept track of that. And when we got to 6 fouls, he would start shouting and jumping and waving his hands from the bench at everybody not to foul anymore.
Playing in the USISL was not glamorous. Far from it, in fact. Life in the lowest rung of the professional ladder was tough for Justin as Coco Expo's teammates. They earned a pittance, if anything at all.
One of the key conflicts of that season is that we did not get paid as we were supposed to be paid. It wasn't very much.
After the first game of the regular season, Justin was the only player on the team to receive his wages, and that was just because he was the only goalkeeper on the club's books, and at this stage in his career, more than willing to walk away from the game. Everyone else would have to play out the rest of the campaign unpaid as the club's owner made excuses and fobbed them off.
Put off and put off, and no one ever got paid.
And then there was the travel.
Back then we would drive to most of the games in a couple of these hulking old white metal vans that I don't recall having air conditioning and weren't very comfortable, and we would actually drive them ourselves. We ate at fast food places. If we played, say, Tampa at 7 o'clock on a Saturday, well, Tampa's 3 hours away, so we'd want to get there by 5, so we'd leave by 2, but we need to get lunch on the way, so maybe we'd leave at 1.
Long, 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 long way home. Long, 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 long way home.
rattle across the state, and Florida, I'm sure everyone knows, particularly in summer, is extremely hot. So we drive across the state being baked in these vans, eat an unappetizing fast food meal, play the game, and then drive right back, maybe get home somewhere around 2 a.m. So you've left it maybe noon that day and gotten back at 2. You know, my recollection of the travel was always being in those vans. This is 1995, so we didn't have tablets, you know, we didn't have iPods. We mostly had to sit there and make conversation with each other, which was fine, except the windows were all down because we didn't have air conditioning, so this wind is roaring through the vans, hot wind. I'm trying to find a way to make it sound romantic and make it sound like it wasn't so bad, but it genuinely was pretty miserable.
The untimely pay, the difficult owner, the quirky rules, the travel. It was a tough old year for Justin, and he was also burdened by something else at that time.
That bad season was a difficult one for me. I wasn't entirely healthy, either physically or emotionally. I was going through a lot of anxiety. I wasn't feeling well. I had some sort of mysterious stomach ailment that had kicked up a few years before that never really got properly diagnosed. And all things considered, it probably was a mistake to play that final season of the Expos.
Despite the off-field issues, Justin found a rich vein of form in his final season.
And we won almost every game I played.
And the Coco Expos easily qualified for the USISL regional playoffs. That was a four-team mini-tournament held in Birmingham, Alabama, that would decide who went on to compete for the national championship. The games were all held over the course of a single weekend, so in order to get there with time to prepare for the upcoming matches, the Expos squad travelled out the Friday before. Well, everyone except for Justin. At the time, he was writing for a soccer magazine, and because of a tight deadline, he couldn't make the Friday flight, so it was decided he'd join his teammates on match day. And I hope this doesn't spoil the surprise for anyone, but I just want to let you know that this is the part of the story where the Valium comes in.
So I got up Saturday morning and drove myself to Orlando International Airport to make the flight. I mentioned that I played that entire season not feeling very well physically and mentally, emotionally. I had a sort of poorly defined sense of stress and anxiety that I couldn't really pinpoint and never really went away. But one thing I knew for sure was that I was claustrophobic. I always have been, and it sort of comes and goes, and when things aren't going well, it's particularly bad, and it was very bad then. So I got into the habit of taking a Valium or two before our flights.
Valium was historically known as Mother's Little Helper because of its usefulness in treating anxiety and panic attacks. It can also be prescribed.
Well, I don't know why. It seems pretty obvious, but I don't know why I didn't think maybe I shouldn't do that when I'm flying on the same day that I'm playing, because previously it had always been the night before. But it was a 9 a.m. flight, and we didn't play till 7 o'clock. I didn't think it'd be a big deal. So I took a Valium before I went to the airport. I got to the airport. I actually got on the plane. They boarded us, and I still had the feeling I tend to get when I'm feeling a little claustrophobic, which is that I begin to feel very anxious physically, fidgety, energetic in the wrong sort of way, a little sweaty. And I knew what was happening, so I thought I'd better take another one. So I had two Valium in me, and we then flew to Birmingham, which was really only, hard to remember now, but it couldn't have been more than an hour flight. And we had a nice flight. I calmed down, and we got to the hotel, and I took a nap, and probably woke up around 3:30, having slept at least 2 hours. And when I woke up at that point, I knew something wasn't quite right. If you've ever taken a nap and you slept for too long, you know the feeling where you were groggy and you actually feel more tired than you did before you took the nap. It was that feeling multiplied at least 10 times. And now I realize that the stuff hadn't worn off.
The most common side effects of Valium include drowsiness, dizziness, and constipation. Tell your physician immediately if you experience slurred speech, tremors, sleep disturbances, yellowing skin, or any other.
And then we left for the stadium. And that's about when, on a normal match day, I would start to feel some pre-match nerves. And I didn't have that. We got to the stadium, and I actually tried to sort of get dressed, get kitted out. And even that was sort of a chore. I remember struggling to pull my socks over my shin pads. The socks were kind of tight. It seemed to take a lot of effort for me to get that done, which is obviously something that shouldn't be hard to do. And the game began. We were better, and we were well on top in that game. And we scored to go ahead, and I had a little thought. I thought, maybe this will be one of those games where we just rattle in goals, and I won't be needed at all. And almost as soon as I thought that, they came away and got a corner. And sure enough, scored a goal that I attribute directly to the Valium. There was a ball played in the 6-yard box, and somebody headed it down into another body, and one of the guys on their side just sort of knocked it in from pretty close range. But it wasn't hit all that well, and it wasn't right in the corner, and I remember sort of diving to save it, thinking, oh, I'll just push around the post, and I just didn't get there. I was
physically slow.
In addition to that groggy feeling and a lack of energy, there was also a heaviness to my limbs. And one of the very first things that I'd done, I remember, is picked up a through ball, and I went to throw it out to my left back, and it felt like the act of throwing the ball across my body over to my left took about 10 seconds. I remember it feeling very slow and very heavy, and sure enough, when that shot came in and I went to dive and try to push around the post, it felt as if I were underwater. There was nobody behind my goal, really, not many people behind the goal. I remember one time a shot went over and no one sort of went to chase it. There was just a grass hill. You know, there were stands on both sides, but just a grass hill behind the goals. And the shot went over and sort of thudded into the grass, and it rolled up the hill a little bit, and it started to roll back down a little bit, and it stopped. And I just sort of pretended I was waiting for someone else to get it. There were no ball boys, and there were no fans, and I thought, well, if I don't get it, if I just stand here, then we don't have to play. And I just stood there for, I don't know, as long as I could get away with it, 10, 12, 25 seconds, a minute. And finally somebody from somewhere shouted, you know, to get the ball. But I was trying these little things to stall and delay and to sort of save myself, because I knew I was in trouble.
Valium creates a powerful inhibitory effect, causing sedation and reducing anxiety.
My entire sense of time sort of underwent some kind of change, because the second half seemed to last forever. I don't know if you've ever had those nights where you can't sleep. You sort of half fall asleep, and then you wake up and you look at your clock and it says like 2:15. And then you fall asleep again, you wake up and you look again and it says 2:27. And you just can't believe it. It seems like time has passed and has elapsed, but none has. That's how that whole game felt, but particularly the second half, because I really wanted this game to end. And in the second half, I started thinking about it ending. I started willing it to end. I started wishing and praying that it would end, and it just wouldn't. Then we did score a couple of goals. And the game more or less churned away at the other end. And I found slowly I was starting to get feeling back in my limbs, and things started to feel a little bit normal again. By the time the game ended, there were really no more disasters that came from it. I got through the second half unscathed. We scored, as I said, a couple more goals, and I think we won going away. But the experience in the first half was frightening. And it was frightening on an intellectual level, not an emotional one, because I couldn't have the real emotional response to it. I couldn't panic because of the Valium. I've never played drunk, but I think it was probably even worse than that, because it messed up my thought process so bad, and so there was some huge disconnect between what I was trying to do and what I was actually able to do. And then, of course, the miracle of it all is that it all worked out in the end.
That story by Justin Bryant was adapted from a book he published last June called Small Time, A Life in the Football Wilderness. You can get it for just $8 on your Kindle. If you want more like it, and I know I mentioned this before, go to howlermagazine.com and order issue 4, which ships next week. The producer of Howler Radio is Matthew Nelson, and the nifty psychedelic music he used throughout the piece is called Wherever by Ben Best and Carl Jorgensen. It was provided to us by the good people at Hell Audio, a Utah-based label of electronic and experimental music. Well, that's it for now, but we'll be back soon with another episode of Howler Radio. I'm George Qureshi. Thanks for listening.